Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, episode 4.34, Boston Liberated. George Washington was itching for a battle. In September, his eyes had turned towards an attack on Boston. Washington reasoned that the time to attack was right then. He was concerned that the winter would take a huge toll on his young army. This is to say nothing of the fact that, like Benedict Arnold to his north, Washington was having to deal with expiring enlistments at the end of the year. At some point, ships were going to appear on the horizon to reinforce Boston, and once that occurred, the Americans were going to have lost their opportunity. Attack now, while the British are low on supplies. Do not give them the opportunity to strengthen their position. Washington's War Council was quick to talk him out of the attack, with only fellow Virginian Charles Lee supporting the assault. However, the idleness was growing old. As 1775 gave way to 1776, Washington was eager to test his new army. Yet, he continued to run headlong into what he viewed to be an overly cautious War Council. Washington felt stuck. Unilateral action was out of the question, as he acted under the belief that such unilateral action went against his powers as granted by the Congress, and that he was to give deference to his most senior officers, the ones who made up his war council. If they said no, Washington felt that his hands were tied, and the answer was indeed no. During the winter of 1776, with the Charles River frozen, Washington was again eyeing an assault on Boston. This surely would have been a dramatic strike. Yet it came with the very real possibility of a disaster for the Americans. What Washington was proposing would have seen his troops move across the frozen river and attack British fortifications inside the city. Already during this war, we have seen on two separate occasions what happens when you attack fortified locations. The first had been on Breed's Hill, where the British had suffered appalling losses. The second was against Quebec, where it was the Americans' turn to suffer a loss. Either way, there was an undeniable risk to such a bold stroke. On the other hand, as one of Washington's generals, Nathaniel Greene, put it, a victory could end the war. Unsurprisingly, given their hesitance back in September, Washington's War Council again shot him down. Although Washington was disappointed, he was not dissuaded. Rather, he kept planning. Maybe he would not be marching an army across the frozen Charles River. However, a new target piqued his interest: Dorchester Heights. If you'll recall from our episode on Bunker Hill, the original British plan had been for the British to seize both Bunker Hill and the Dorchester Heights. However, that never happened, and as of February 1776, the Heights remained ripe for the taking. Now, unlike his previous plans, Washington's War Council did not outright balk at this proposal. Should the Americans be able to capture the Heights, fortify it, and get cannon up there, they could potentially begin shelling Boston. This possibility meant that if the Americans could indeed establish their position on the Heights, General Howe, who had officially taken over command from Thomas Gage the previous summer, would have to respond. Really, the only option that would be on the table for Howe in this case would be to launch a direct assault on the American position, ideally setting up a repeat of the Battle of Bunker Hill. Whereas Washington's War Council was not in love with the idea of Washington marching troops towards positions fortified by the British, the plan to take the Heights avoided that problem altogether. There would be no storming of British fortified positions. This offered the Americans a chance to repeat their biggest victory in the war yet. Now, for this plan to work, the Americans were going to need artillery. A lot of artillery. Luckily, this is something that they had an abundance of, thanks to the help of Henry Knox. Today is not the first time that we have met Henry Knox, although I would fully understand if you did not remember the first time he came up. Way back, in our episode on the Boston Massacre, Knox had given Thomas Preston a warning that should he do something stupid and fire on the growing crowd, the crowd would kill him. Of course, Preston's men did not heed the warning from Knox, and did indeed do something stupid and fired on the crowd. Although the crowd did not kill Preston or his men, it was not for lack of desire. Born on July 15, 1750, Henry Knox was just 25 years old when he found himself being placed in charge of the fledgling American Army's artillery. A bookseller by trade, the young Henry Knox found himself reading just about anything he could get his hands on, with a particular interest in books on military matters. Knox had grown up in Boston, and had, for a time, attended the well-regarded Boston Latin School, a common step for many of our New England revolutionaries. Despite this good start, life was anything but easy for the young Henry Knox, whose father had abandoned him and his family when he was just 9 years old. Following school, Knox would find an apprenticeship in the bookselling industry, where he would quickly find an opportunity to largely self-educate himself. Knox would likewise gain a reputation for his sheer size, something that has become one of the most commonly mentioned characteristics of the man. His size helped earn him a reputation as a young man of being something of a fighter, as he became a common fixture in those gangs of Boston that were so prevalent during the Imperial Crisis. These gangs were the same ones who each year in November on Pope's Day would revel at the opportunity to cause general mayhem on the streets of Boston. It is these same gangs of boys that would help explain just what Christopher Snyder was doing in the days before the Boston Massacre that would help contribute to his death. Knox was, like John Hancock, involved in the local militia. During the Boston response to the Tea Act, it was Knox's grenadiers that were busy guarding the Dartmouth to make sure that nobody got any crazy ideas of attempting to unload the tea. Although it is not clear that Knox had anything to do with the destruction of the tea himself, he certainly was sympathetic to the cause. Ironically, as Knox is busy with this, he was also busy courting Lucy Flucker, the daughter of Thomas Flucker, a secretary who had been royally appointed to his position. Now, we have also met Flucker once before, back in episode 4.23, although this was a very brief meeting. Recall back when the Massachusetts Assembly had been removed to Salem, and was seemingly working with Thomas Gage, well, really working behind his back? When Gage found out, he rushed a secretary out to disband the assembly. The secretary, upon his arrival, found that the doors were locked and then just basically had to shout through the doors that the assembly was dismissed. Yeah, that was Thomas Flucker. So you can imagine just how happy he was that his daughter was going to marry Henry Knox. For Lucy, this marriage and coming war would leave her estranged from her family. Knox had to slip out of Boston along with Lucy following the events of Lexington and Concord. Quickly, once into the American camp, Knox, with the support of Artemus Ward, was given work at training the men on the use of artillery. Upon his arrival, Washington, too, took an immediate liking to Knox, who quickly found himself becoming a regular member of Washington's military family. In short order, Knox was made a lieutenant colonel and put in charge of the artillery corps. There, however, was a problem. Over the summer of 1775, the army outside of Boston had a very serious shortage of artillery, a particular problem for Knox, who now found himself in charge of the very limited collection. Thankfully, for everybody, there was a plan B here. Recall back to when Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold had marched into Ticonderoga and Crown Point and handily defeated a dozen or so sleeping soldiers. The artillery from these forts had been gathered up and stored at Ticonderoga. By the end of October, Washington decided that he wanted these guns, and the task of bringing them back the 300 miles to Massachusetts fell to none other than the new artillery commander, Henry Knox. leaving on November 16th. Nothing about what Knox was setting out to do was going to be easy. However, the difficulty was different from what Knox had probably expected. The trip from Boston to Ticonderoga was right around 300 miles, filled with hills and rivers and just generally rough terrain. Not to mention that November in New England and upstate New York is not exactly regarded for its balmy conditions. Although cold was something that nobody in the army really looks forward to, in this case, Knox was dependent upon there being a heavy snowfall. His plan was to get to the fort, haul the cannons down Lake George, where they would be unloaded onto giant sleds and moved across the snow. There was a problem, however. Knox was building these huge sleds, which were very much predicated upon there being snow to move said sleds across. For what would be the first time, and really the only time in the entire revolution, Knox had a very serious shortage of snow. Knox was not just moving a few pieces either, but rather an estimated 120,000 pounds of artillery. After a slog down Lake George that saw him battle fierce headwinds, Knox still only had a light dusting of snow on the ground, leaving him all but completely stranded. He would have to wait at Fort George. Then, on Christmas Day, all of the snow came. At once. A blizzard rolled in and promptly dropped 3 feet of snow on Knox and his men. Although this was enough for Knox to begin his journey south, at the very beginning of the year he would be hit with another unwelcome thaw, further slowing his progress. It was not until January 7th that Knox would make it down to Albany. In one instance, a cannon went crashing through the ice while crossing a river. Undaunted, rather than leaving the cannon behind, Knox retrieved it. After a brief rest in Albany, on January 9th, the artillery train set out to cover the final 100 miles to the American camp in Cambridge. This was no easy trip either, as the men were forced to deal with often treacherous terrain. Yet, they kept moving forward until January 25th, when they finally arrived some 20 miles outside of Boston. On this 300-mile journey that had taken 2.5 months, Henry Knox had delivered to the American cause a gift capable of turning the course of the battle. Despite the miserable conditions, Knox had managed to make the journey without losing even a single gun. The guns delivered by Knox were a game changer, not to mention a very nice morale boost for the men camped outside of Boston. Taking the heights was a thing, but Washington needed those cannons to pose any meaningful threat to the British. If he was going to force Howe's hand, he needed the cannons to convince him that the Americans needed to be evicted from the heights. Yet, even here, Washington was not yet ready to let his previous plan drop. Forcing the British into storming the American defensive positions was great and all, but what Washington was craving was an offensive. Goading the British into an assault was not exactly that. Washington, therefore, decided to modify the plans a bit. What he envisioned was a situation where one group would head over, take the Dorchester Heights, install the cannons, and draw Howe out. When Howe inevitably engaged and moved his troops towards the American position, Washington would lead a second group of roughly 4,000 men across the river to attack a suddenly exposed Boston. Despite some grumbling from his war council, eventually they agreed to Washington's plan. With the plan set and the cannons, courtesy of Henry Knox, ready to go, Washington began preparations for the battle. Now, taking the heights was not going to be as easy as strolling over there and taking up a position. In order to distract the British from the real mission, on March 2nd, the Americans opened up a bombardment of Boston. The plan was for this to go on for 3 days. Everything went as planned for the first 2 days, with the bombardment growing substantially larger on the third day. The bombardment was not really intended to do much more than rattle some nerves. The British, wanting to make sure that the Americans lacked the right to attack with impunity, followed up with their own counter-bombardment. However, other than harassing the other side, the real point of this by the Americans was to draw the British attention away from the real mission. On March 4th, the Americans really opened up, throwing everything that they had at the British. This increase coincided with the American efforts to actually establish their position atop the heights. The Americans had, at least, some experience at quickly throwing up a fortification. They had, after all, done exactly that back in June on Breed's Hill. However, doing so in early March was going to bring with it substantial challenges that were not present during the Battle of Bunker Hill. Chiefly, the problem was the cold. Unlike back during the battle that previous June, the men could not simply dig trenches around the hill. The cold meant that the ground was still frozen, and that if getting set up over the course of a single night was paramount, digging into the frozen earth was not going to be an option. Instead, what the Americans did was a bit of prefabrication. Rather than pointlessly trying to dig into the frozen ground, the men constructed frames on the ground, brought them up the hill, and covered them with dirt. They brought along baskets of rocks that could be used for stacking. They could likewise repurpose the barrels that carried up the ammunition into objects that could be rolled down the hill at would-be British attackers. As the artillery barrage raged on, American forces were able to take nearby Nook's Hill. Now, this was not some Breed's Hill instead of Bunker Hill plan, but rather Nook's Hill was just meant to be a temporary stopping point to provide cover for those working on the heights. From the position on Nook's Hill, there was a clear view of Boston and Castle William. If the British caught on that something was happening, the men on Nook's Hill would be able to see it and get a warning over to the heights. Throughout the early morning of March 5th, the 6th anniversary of the Boston Massacre, men worked relentlessly at setting themselves up on Dorchester Heights. The ongoing cannonade was distracting enough, and it would mask the noise so that nobody in Boston noticed what was happening. When first light came, General Howe was stunned to find two redoubts were now in place on the heights. This was a stunning accomplishment for the Americans, and a most unwelcome one for the British. As stunned by the developments as he might be, Howe knew that an immediate response was going to be required. Just as planned, Howe could not leave the Americans in control over the heights without exposing Boston. His first move was to attempt to blast them off the heights. However, after a few hours of trying, it became clear that he could not actually hit the American position. Howe was left with only a single option. If he was going to get the Americans off of the Dorchester Heights, he was going to need to drive them off with an assault. Howe, of course, had been on the ground back in June when a frontal assault on Breed's Hill had extracted a huge toll. The idea of a repeat of that, which looked like a distinct possibility here, was not exactly something that he was excited about. However, he had little other choice. The Americans on the heights posed a serious threat, and they needed to be driven off. Meanwhile, back in Cambridge to the north, Washington was busy preparing his 4,000 men for their own assault on Boston. No longer able to cross the frozen river as he had originally planned, as the weather had turned warmer, the men in Cambridge amassed flat-bottomed boats to move across the river in. As soon as the signal was given that Howe's men were advancing on the heights, a signal that would come from the steeple of the nearby Roxbury Church, the Americans under Israel Putnam would begin their own assault of a hopefully overextended and weakened Boston. For General Howe, who is now very quickly making up plans for his assault on the heights, he found very little in the way of support for his planned attack. Captain Archibald Robertson was convinced that the mission was one of pure madness, and did all that he could to take down the names of like-minded officers to convince Howe not to undertake this suicide mission. Regardless of these reservations from his officers, however, we know that Howe's mind was seemingly made up. General James Grant would later write that Howe was very actively preparing for an assault. This is, should you be wondering, the same James Grant who nearly blew up the Easton Conference back in 1758. This is also the same James Grant who had forced the Cherokee surrender during their rebellion, something that we had talked about in our first episode this season. So, yeah, if you're wondering, he is still around. The attack was to begin on March the 6th. 2,400 British troops took their transports over to the eastern part of the Dorchester Peninsula, where they awaited their orders to advance. The British advance would come in two columns, with one group coming from the east and another moving up the northern part of the hill. All anybody could do now was sit and wait. The planned attack, however, would never come. In what was a stroke of either very bad luck, or more realistically, very good luck for the British, before Howe could launch his assault, it began to rain. A heavy storm blew through, causing the ships in the harbor to get battered from the high winds and the heavy tides. They were going to provide virtually no help to the men on the ground. At the same time, if the mission was already running so much risk of being a repeat of Bunker Hill, a slippery climb up a muddy hill did not do much to increase Howe's chances of this not being an outright slaughter. The storm that blew in would rage for 2 days, thoroughly soaking everybody and everything. For the Americans, this was a boon, as it gave them 2 extra days to keep working, to keep digging in, to ensure that life for the British was going to be that much worse. On the surface, nothing sounds good about this for General Howe. His chances of success were not exactly improving as the rain poured down. Really, everything here does sound a lot like a much worse version of Bunker Hill. We can't say exactly what would have happened, but it is not out of the question that the British would have suffered absolutely devastating casualties had they assaulted the Dorchester Heights. Those extra days gave Howe a chance to let the shock wear off and allowed him to fully grasp the position that he now found himself in. Realizing the risks that would come with attempting to drive the Americans off of the heights, Howe conceded and called off the planned assault. General Howe really only had 2 options now. Either get the Americans off of the Dorchester Heights or evacuate Boston, leaving it to the Americans. With the planned attack being called off, Howe's only choice was to evacuate. On March 8th, Howe sent a group of Boston selectmen, loyalists, to parley with Washington. Howe informed Washington of his intention to evacuate the city, and gave him a choice. Howe told Washington that if the Americans allowed the British to withdraw peacefully, and did not use those cannons on the heights to blast the British Navy to bits, he would leave the city intact. If, on the other hand, Washington decided to press his advantage and attack, Howe would reduce Boston to rubble. Understanding that the destruction of Boston would bring with it a terrible blow to the morale of the Americans, not just in Boston, but throughout all of the colonies, he chose to allow Howe to leave without a fight. In the back of Washington's head was the fact that the battle was going to be moving south, likely to New York. The last thing that he would have wanted was for the local population in New York to be dwelling on the destruction of Boston as he tried to rally them to the fight. With the decision that was made, Howe would be allowed to leave, and Boston would be saved. The end finally came on March 17th, when over 9,000 British troops and an additional 1,000 Loyalists evacuated Boston. The Americans, not wanting to see Boston destroyed, did not attempt to interfere with the evacuation. Instead, they allowed the British to board their ships unmolested and sail away. The war had been going on for just under a year. Since at least the summer of 1774, Boston had really been the only part of Massachusetts that was meaningfully under British control in any sense of the word. Now, however, it was over. The British would never again return to Boston. Forcing the British evacuation from Boston was undoubtedly a huge deal. Boston had long been at the center of the conflict, going back to the beginning of the imperial crisis. Symbolically, there might not have been a more important city anywhere in the colonies. However, in terms of this being some fantastic military victory, that becomes a bit more difficult to support. Really, the Americans taking the Dorchester Heights did not, in and of itself, convince the British to leave Boston. Rather, it convinced the British to leave Boston in March 1776. Following the victory, everybody was pretty thrilled, except for George Washington. Washington had been itching for a battle for a while. Back in September of 75, he wanted to try that new army of his out. As we know, he was shot down by his senior generals. Again, though, in February, he wanted to launch an invasion into Boston across the frozen Charles River, and once again he was rebuffed. The plan to take the Dorchester Heights had always been Washington's silver medal. It wasn't what he wanted, but it was about as much as he could get anybody on board with. In an attempt to salvage the situation and give his army a much-needed victory, it was Washington who set up in Cambridge with plans to head into Boston behind the British troops attempting to recapture the Heights. Now, however, even that was gone. Despite the apparent victory, Washington was disappointed that securing such a victory never actually required military strength, but rather came as a function of an, albeit amazing, feat of engineering and a conveniently timed storm. Washington had long suspected that Howe was not long for Boston, regardless of any attempt on the Dorchester Heights. As it turns out, Washington was correct in this assumption. Howe had indeed been given orders months before to abandon Boston, although he stalled for months in the hope that he could escape the city with as many men and supplies as possible. The seizure of the Dorchester Heights did nothing to convince Howe that he needed to leave. It merely set the timetable for him to leave. Conveniently for Washington, Howe's intention to leave Boston was not something that most people were aware of. So as disappointed as he might be, it was still portrayed as a much-needed American victory. None of this is really terribly surprising either. Long before March 17, 1776, the British had lost control over Massachusetts. Going all the way back to the powder alarms in the late summer of 1774, the imperial grip on the colony had been slipping. Following the attack at Lexington and Concord the previous spring, Boston had essentially been under siege, with the British having bleak prospects of ever breaking out. Sure, they could be resupplied via Boston Harbor, but it isn't as though there was much hope for the British to get out of Boston and make any progress. When Washington took the Heights, he pushed Howe to finally make that decision that it was no longer worth the cost of holding Boston. The evacuation itself was relatively orderly. The city was left with damage, to be sure, but it was not completely destroyed. Among the first men back into the city was Israel Putnam, who reported happily that the city, though a bit worse for the wear, had survived the battle in far better condition than anybody could have realistically hoped for. Washington was pleased to see that there was a good amount of supplies left in the city that the Americans could use. Things did proceed cautiously for the next few days, as Howe just lingered off the coast. On March 20th, the British destroyed Castle William, rather than allowing it to fall into the hands of the Americans. Although some 1,000 Loyalists got out of Boston with the British troops, those who remained found themselves facing an uncertain future. Although many held out for the triumphant return of the British, others were well aware that the British would never again control the city. On March 27th, Howe and the British finally set sail towards Halifax, ending any lingering threat that they presented. With Boston now secured, the next question turned to what was next. The war was clearly not over. The British were not just walking away and leaving the Americans to their own devices. So where would the next battle come? This was not really that much of a mystery, however, as everybody knew that the next time they saw Lord Howe, it was going to be in New York. On March 18th, the day after the evacuation, Washington was already beginning the process of shifting troops around as he began sending men off towards New York. The Americans had won the day. They had retaken Boston, but the war was far from over, a fact that George Washington was keenly aware of. Next time, as George Washington moves his forces to the south, to New York, in Congress a new battle would begin. After spending nearly a year holding out desperate hope that reconciliation may be possible, the conversation begins to shift to the ultimate question of the purpose of this war. Do the North American British colonies have a role to play in the greater British Empire? Or, instead, is it time that those colonies declare their independence once and for all? Until then, I hope you have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you all back here next time as the colonies begin to consider independence.